Hi, this is Morgan Michael welcoming you to Kindsight 101, the podcast, where you'll hear from world-renowned educational leaders about the mobilizing power of kindness. I believe that we all have an innate need to be seen, heard, and understood. When we dedicate ourselves to kindness, the ripple effects in our schools can be life-changing. Through this podcast, I want to challenge you to question your assumptions, amplify your insight, and embrace a willingness to go beyond the status quo in education. Together, let's learn how to make a big impact, one small act at a time. Have you ever wanted to start your own school? This discussion will have you wanting to rethink the way you approach education in your own classroom. My guest explores the importance of creating a school that values student voice, utilizes the inquiry process to prepare students for an uncertain future, and focuses on the importance of creating a psychologically safe classroom culture in order to foster creativity and innovation. Hope you love it as much as I did. Jeff Hopkins is the founder and principal educator of the Pacific School of Innovation and Inquiry, an independent high school in Victoria, Canada, designed to provide a model for educational systems transformations. His TED Talk, Education as If People Mattered, and An Inquiry Approach to Education have earned him global attention. Find him by searching Pacific School of Innovation and Inquiry. For more information, visit my website, smallactbigimpact.com, and search for episode 8. I want to thank you for the wonderful reviews that you've left for this podcast on iTunes. Your reviews make a big difference in helping other educators find this show. If you think that I'm doing good work here and you'd like others to get inspired and join our 21-day kindness challenge and movement, I'd love it if you would take a minute, head over to iTunes and leave a review. Thank you so much. I know that you're the founder and the principal educator of the Pacific School of Innovation and Inquiry, an independent innovative high school in Victoria, and it's designed to provide a model for education system transformation. So when I think about honoring the individual child and their interests, it seems as though that's essentially what you're doing with your school.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
So I know that you've stated in the past that students are not pails to be filled and that we should be really lighting a fire. What does authentic learning mean to you?
Well, to me, I think it means rather than trying to guess at a universal set of content or a universal set of skills even, while there may be some things that are foundational that everyone should know, I think more importantly, it's recognizing that each person has an individual lens through which they should learn those skills or content. So to me, it's about finding the passion that someone has, the interests that they have, and the skills they already have, and build on that, use that as the doorway through which we can teach them all sorts of other things, including things they don't even know that they don't know yet.
I love that. And I think it's a very different model from how traditional mainstream education has played out in the past and up until, in some areas, the present. What would you say are the main differences between your school or an inquiry-based approach and the mainstream school system?
The biggest difference is probably that the teachers don't decide what people are going to learn ahead of time. In my old life, I used to prepare everything madly well before I ever met any of my students, and then I would meet them and would sort of unfold something that I had planned long ago by myself, usually at night at home. And now it's I wait until I meet my students. I help them develop a set of questions that allow them to go deep into areas of interest. And we build the curriculum around those questions, no matter what they are. So the other difference that comes from that is they're usually completely interdisciplinary, and they can also take very short periods of time or very long periods of time. I've worked with some learners where their inquiries take multiple years, and other ones where they just take maybe a week or even a few days. So they usually have more than one inquiry going at a time.
I love that, and I can certainly relate to the preparation and the over-preparation that one does as a teacher to feel prepared, even though really what you're dealing with is all sorts of uncertainty. And so on that note, many teachers go into teaching often because of sort of this element of certainty that perhaps we experienced at school or that we even enjoyed at school. And this whole inquiry-based process may not appeal to everyone. You know, this idea of changing the status quo because it somehow worked for us. So the belief is that it should work for everyone else. But many of the teachers, you know, sort of like this correct answer and a clear path to that answer and how to teach our children. And really what you're suggesting is the opposite, is that we don't have the answers and that that reflects the outside world. And most maybe aren't entrepreneurial risk takers themselves. So what do you say to teachers who are fearful of that uncertain path associated with the inquiry model? Just to sort of maybe change their minds a little bit, because I think that really is such a challenge maybe that is before us.
Yeah, I would agree. I think the hardest thing about being a teacher in this new model, if you're not used to it, is that your metrics about how you are performing as a teacher are completely different. I know I used to be very disappointed if I had planned a lesson and then somehow it didn't go the way I had sort of thought it would go, or I didn't sort of take my learners to the destination that I had sort of hoped for or planned in my head. And now I'm completely refocused in the way that I help the learners establish their questions, but then also their goals. And then my measuring how I am as a teacher is the degree to which people are meeting those goals. So it's not chaotic in any way, and it actually becomes very predictable. The difference is that it's not me doing the predicting unilaterally. It's me helping learners develop a predictable pathway with me. We call it co-construction. As a teacher, you just have to, you're refocusing yourself on the learner's goals instead of your goals.
Right, which is exactly the most powerful aspect of teaching, when you see kids kind of enter this state of flow, and that's where the real learning kind of happens, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes.
I'd like to ask you a little bit about what you would also say to a teacher who says that inquiry-based learning can only be done in sort of a private school, very controlled setting. What about the need, the need for meeting students where they're at in terms of special needs, or in terms of the role of inclusion and culture creation within your school? So how does the inquiry-based model apply itself to the inclusion mentality and theory right now?
Well, I think I'm very happy to answer this question, and it comes up a lot. One of the things we're trying to model in our school is a real, cross-section of society. We've done things to make sure that learners can attend our school with a variety of needs, learning needs, different levels on the financial ladder, all sorts of things. So we have a real cross-section, very, very typical, just like what you would have in any public school in our city. And what we found is the personalization that we achieve with inquiry-based learning is actually almost like everybody having an individual education plan. And really, by developing individual goals for people, we're sort of achieving the ideal platform that you would use for students with special needs in any school. We just do it with everybody. So in our school right now, we have 86 learners, and each of them has a completely personalized learning plan, including strategies for how they're going to achieve their goals, the way they like to learn best. We have differentiated settings and spaces in the school so people can learn about self-regulation and how to sort of manage their own ability to regulate their environment the best. So they learn a lot about themselves. And they can also choose what kind of a day they're going to have. So if they want to be in a lot of group sessions because that's how they learn best, or that's how they'd like to learn that day, then they are. And if they would rather be working in small groups or even independently, they can also choose to do that. And we adapt to that on the fly. So it's probably, no, actually not probably, it is the most inclusive place I've ever worked. Mm-hmm. And that was part of the design as well.
Yes. And I really love that. And I can appreciate that. It's almost like a mastermind setting. Would you agree that there's sort of this drawing of people from many different disciplines and many different interests, which mirrors the real world, and that they can actually work together on different projects and support one another? Can you speak to that a little bit?
I sure can. The inquiries that the learners have often intersect with one another, and we're not a project-based learning school per se, but there are definitely projects that from time to time fall under the umbrella of people's inquiry. Lots of room for collaboration. And what we often find is that people will collaborate on something, but they're collaborating for different reasons with different skill sets, and they each have different goals inside that collaboration. So instead of having, you know, a group project, quote unquote, where everybody, you know, creates something and then maybe stands at the front of the class one day and presents a poster together or something, this is a little more realistic, a little more authentic. And perhaps one person is contributing art, another person's contributing writing, another person's contributing, you know, computer science skills, and another person is doing the presentation. So there's no need for each of them to be a, you know, a clone of each other or to share every piece, but they do have to figure out how those pieces fit together in a smooth, seamless way, just like in the real world.
That's right. Yes. And you did sort of, you differentiated that your program is not a project-based learning institution, but would you draw the distinction between the two, between inquiry-based learning and project-based learning? Because I think for many educators, it's sometimes the two terms are used interchangeably.
They are, and I wish they weren't, because they're very, very different. Mm. If you read the literature on it, but also in practice and by design. I like project-based learning, and there's nothing wrong with it, and there's probably a bit of an overlap from time to time. But for us, the difference is we don't want every learner to focus on a tangible outcome, mm. because sometimes for some students that can actually kind of pin them into a consumer-producer paradigm. And we really don't want that. We want to make sure the learners understand their goal is learning. And if that learning results in a tangible product, that's great. And if their learning doesn't result in a tangible product, that's great. There is something lovely from time to time about doing a project and seeing, you know, a result of something. But that's not always the most important learning that a person has to do.
That is so wonderful. And it really echoes, I'm a big fan of Seth Godin and his work around exactly that paradigm. The idea that we are not learning or creating with necessarily the end in mind or this product, that essentially the goal is to mass produce and make everybody happy, which can be a really torturous project and situation. And you certainly wouldn't want our learners to put themselves in that situation as the purpose. So yeah. I can really appreciate that. And I think that's such an important message to be sending students, because I think when it comes to really important entrepreneurial endeavors, that really some of the most successful ones are really not geared toward the mass. It's geared toward their interests and scratching their own itch. Can you talk a little bit about how your school prepares an entrepreneurial spirit for the real world?
I can. I like the way you said that about scratching their own itch. We had one girl comes to mind a couple of years ago. She was really interested in Christmas, all things Christmas. And she starts counting down Christmas about now.
Yes.
And she wanted to open a Christmas store. And so we approached the landlord in the city, and they had an empty storefront, and we just asked them if we could have it for a short period of time to do a pop-up shop. And he felt that based on our proposal that he'd rather have someone in the store at Christmas than have an empty shop. Sure. So he said, sure, come on in. And then she said, well, how am I going to get product when I don't have any money? I said, I don't know. Let's figure that out. So she did a bit of research and decided to go with a consignment style. Okay. And she curated all of the things that came in from artisans around the city, and she filled the store in about a week, and she made about $15,000 in 6 weeks.
Wow.
So it really came from her own interest in Christmas, and she really wanted to just have this experience of running a Christmas shop and being surrounded by, you know, all things Christmas. And it ended up being very successful. And she donated half of her money to a charity. And then she paid little bonuses to all the students who helped her, who thought they were being volunteers, but actually got a little gift from her as well.
That is such a great story. I love that. And I think how incredibly empowering for her and for her ability to adapt and apply that to her future endeavors. It's very exciting. I know Sean Acor, who is he's an author specifically on happiness, but on many, many different topics. He talks about this concept of the Zorro circle. So this idea that, and you may be familiar with this, but this idea that when you keep you sort of master your inner circle of ability, you can apply that then to more and more circles that get bigger and bigger. So in terms of experience, you're able to apply your past experiences and move that sort of in a forward direction in your life. So you can apply it in many different ways. Can you talk about how students have been able to do that as they move through and increase maybe the scope of their projects or even their feeling of just their ability to tackle new projects and the confidence that some of these, the whole process really gives them to go forward in the future?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if you're familiar with Martin Brokenleg, but he's from South Dakota, and he's talked before about how different people should have different learning goals. And he sort of, this is a shortening of his story, which is a good one, but how if someone in a community spoke too much and too often and dominated conversations, their learning should probably be about how to restrain that. And people who don't speak enough, their learning should probably be how to speak more and you know, voice their ideas. So we have, there's a boy in our school this year who has been with us for, this is his third year. And when he started, he really just wanted to learn how to make a website. That's all he wanted to do. I just want to make a website. And he didn't know anything about it. And he really knew really nothing about it at all. And now he's at the point where he custom designs websites from scratch. He doesn't use any themes or WordPress or anything like that. Wow. And he's doing logo design for companies. Mm-hmm. His fear has been also, sort of contacting people in the community who he doesn't know and going into like meeting new people and things. He's a bit introverted in that way. Mm-hmm. And so now that he's got this skill and this strength, he's feeling confident to do that. So yesterday he had a business person in the school who's hired him to do a logo for his company. And at the same time as he was in sort of discussing the logo that he wanted designed, he's also acting as a mentor for the student to help him with his business model for his logo design business. So he's sort of acting as his mentor and his client at the same time.
Wow.
And I was watching them and I was just thinking, there is no way he would have had that conversation. I could never have dragged him into a meeting like that 2 years earlier or even a year earlier, but he now has confidence in something. And it doesn't really matter what you have confidence in. You just need confidence in something. And you can start to expand your schema that way.
Absolutely. I think that's another wonderful story. And you think about the mutual benefit of this for both parties, for the student obviously learning and having that connection, but I think also for the business leader to be able to give back and mentor, because sometimes it's not always easy to find the people who want that level of expertise, and you know, it's just an amazing mutually beneficial relationship. And I think back to this whole idea, you know, my project around kindness is really founded in the brain science of kindness, which is this reciprocal relationship where you get this kindness boost, not only when you're the receiver of a kind act, but also when you're the giver of a kind act or when you witness it. So, I mean, that's a really important piece of this, is the relationships that these people are building in doing these things for one another, which is wonderful. Just to switch gears a little bit, I recently read the book Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari. Yes. And he argues with every innovative revolution, the cognitive, art, you know, agricultural, scientific, and industrial, we've made ourselves more and more dependent on our lifestyles. And there's been sort of a price for the planet to pay and also its inhabitants for mankind's triumphant progress. I've heard, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that innovation and sustainability are key aspects of your philosophy as an educational leader. Can you speak more to that? And I remember hearing this story about the Cuba bus trip. I just thought that was such a great illustration of that philosophy.
Sure. Yeah. There's many stories, yes. But I will say that, I do believe that innovation is not just, that isn't just possible to coexist with sustainability, but I do believe that it's necessary. I don't think we're going to be able to survive as a species for very long unless we begin to innovate in some areas where we've never really innovated before. it's an unfortunate pattern that human beings tend to wait quite a long time before we find solutions to some of our biggest problems. Mm-hmm. We sort of seem to wait till the last minute, but I do feel like, there's a book called Ishmael in which there's an analogy where he describes, everything seems fine, to a person if, if you were falling off a cliff, and you've stopped accelerating, it doesn't feel like you're accelerating and it just feels fine. It feels like you're in stasis and it's normal.
Sure.
But that doesn't necessarily mean you're not plummeting towards the ground. So I think that the innovation that we need right now is to sort of, help us get out of this complacent status quo that we're in. That's I think pretty fragile and pretty artificial. Mm-hmm. And begin to develop new ways of being. I think even kindness is almost something that requires innovation right now. Mm. As we built quite a bit of our world on, not to say people are necessarily going out of their way to be unkind, but I think kindness is almost seen as a nice thing if you can do it. But you know, it's sort of the soft stuff that comes after you take care of yourself.
Right.
And I just think we've got it backwards. So I feel that a lot of innovation in the area of kindness is going to make our world a better place.
I agree. I absolutely do agree. I want to talk a little bit about the fact that you yourself, as an educational leader, you are pursuing the inquiry-based model yourself. And I really think that in order to adopt the inquiry process and actually bring it into our classrooms, it's really helpful for us to have experience with it ourselves, and primarily with the experience of failure, because, and however, you know, you may use that word, you may not use the word failure, but challenges, adversity, whatever it is. I think sometimes when we do tend to gear ourselves more toward the certainty piece, we're less likely to put ourselves in risk-taking type situations or situations that might feel risky. So can you talk a little bit about how your own experience with the inquiry model, especially I think about starting a new school and all of the different things that you must have encountered along your journey, how that's informed you and has essentially made you a better educational leader?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and I know that it has. I've learned a lot. And I was in the safe zone for a long time. I was a very young principal and a very young superintendent. I was sort of, I had the game figured out and I knew that I could sort of continue along that path if I wanted to. So when I quit my job and mortgaged my house and started a school, it was a bit of a risk. And there was a day when I was standing on the roof of the terrible little building that we rented for our first school before we moved to the second place that we're in now, in the pouring rain at the end of October, shoveling leaves out of the sort of the gutter on the side of the roof so that it wouldn't collapse with the weight of the water that wasn't going down the drain. And I just felt terrible. And I just thought, I have absolutely blown it. Like this is a low point. And I was getting sick and I could just feel a cold coming. And I think I sort of remember back to that when our learners are going through an inquiry process and they are hitting snags or challenges or outright failure. Mm. And I have empathy for them. Mm. I can be very compassionate because I can remember what that feels like very, very easily because it wasn't that long
Absolutely.
Ago. And then help them through it and just say, you're going to get through this. It's going to be okay. You know, you will come down off the roof. It will stop raining. the roof is probably not going to collapse. And your risk was worth taking. And I think in school, sometimes we tell people that we want them to take risks, but I don't really think we provide an environment for that. If everything you're doing is going to land as a number on a spreadsheet in a mark book, I think we need to let people fail and say, fail, learn from it, and let's count that later when you've dug yourself out of the failure. I'm not going to count the failure.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, I guess I wonder how you might guide a teacher who perhaps has that mindset to adopt and embrace this idea that failure is a learning point, that even if the students in your classroom, I'm thinking specifically of STEM, and I'm thinking of that in a mainstream classroom where I've spoken to a lot of my colleagues who are very reluctant to do STEM or have tried it once or twice and just don't want to do it again because kids are crying and kids are on the floor and they're just there fighting and it seems so messy. And I think my belief is that Well, of course. And I think if we talk about this idea that there's a growth mindset and you really talk about all of the other pieces before you even dive into the STEM, and that you're not just doing the STEM or the inquiry-based learning as a one-off. It's your approach for the whole year, and you're building, and essentially the skills that they're building is what they bring with them in the following years. So can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. It can be very messy. We even tell our learners when they're new to the school and their parents, we say in about the third week of October, your children will be really doubting their choice of choosing our school, and you will also. And just so you know, it's coming. And then sure enough, it does. But because we've told them, it's a little bit of a softer landing, because they suddenly realize that we really aren't talking about sort of faking it. This is real. You're really doing inquiry-based learning all the time. Mm-hmm. And it's not a little one-off, and it's not a little unit that ends and we're trying it out and then we go back to the real world. So then along with that, it really is helping people make good, authentic reflections on what they are learning, because sometimes it's very difficult to see a competency, for example, being built over a long period of time. It's not something you can look back on and say, oh, I got 10 out of 10 on that quiz. I must be doing all right. So we have to help people create a different set of benchmarks, I guess, so that they can see how they are making progress. So if it is a mess and they do feel like crying or something just, you know, really just blew apart or fell apart or just didn't ever kind of see itself through to fruition, they can see, they have a bit of a trail of breadcrumbs for themselves to see that they have learned something and there has been some, marked competency development along the way.
Absolutely. So what type of reflection do you get them to do? I mean, I'm sure there are many different ones, but maybe you have a couple of examples that help them to tune into that authentic learning and become more aware or metacognitively sort of tuned into that. Because I think that often is overlooked in schools. And I think that that's one of the most important things that I've learned about myself as an adult learner, is to be tuned into that.
Yeah, I think me too. So we've done a couple of things. We've created a couple of tools that help people be reflective very easily on the fly. We have an electronic portfolio that is really just a blog, and people can write in it. And then we've created tags in that blog that are competencies like ecological literacy and collaboration and leadership and things like that. So as they're writing about something they've done, and it could be very quick. It could also be a photo or a video or a voice recording or, you know, anything really. They can annotate that if they want to and then tag it. So they always have a running record of reflection of some kind. That's one thing. The other thing is we make sure that we have time always to have conversations with our learners one-to-one with a teacher or more than one teacher usually through the week. So really all day, every day, they are having conversations about this. So really they're always reflecting.
Yes.
And it's hard to describe that to someone who's in a system where you have, you know, your block schedule and the bells ringing and you're rushing from class to class. You might say, how on earth do you have time for that? Mm-hmm. But we don't do that because we just decided you can't be reflective in that system. So we're not doing that. Mm. So we have made time to be able to spend that kind of time with our learners.
That's wonderful. That is. So when they are going through a hard time or a difficult challenge, for example, what is the kind of, how do you support them? And I guess I'm asking also when it reflects or when it comes to your own difficult times, what type of self-talk would have gotten you through those times? And then how do you apply that to your students?
Well, that's really interesting. And it is about self-talk, actually. I have a psychology background and I know the power of reframing. Mm. So sometimes it's just helping somebody, you know, it's kind of like the difference between it's raining outside or it's raining on me. it's two very different things. And so sometimes it's just reminding somebody that you're experiencing something that's happening, but it's not happening just to ruin your day. Or even just helping them find the positive learning bits in what they're doing or even helping people say, let's abandon this. This isn't good for you right now. Let's just put it back in the parking lot and maybe look at it again sometime, or maybe not. Like, let's move on here. We've also seen kids who, you know, this highlights insecurities in people, where they find the areas that they really have feared to go, where the, yes. you know, where they're just really quite worried about even dipping their toe in. And so sometimes that self-talk is just, you know, what's the worst thing that's going to happen? How can we construct this for you so that it's a risk, but it's as safe as it can possibly be? You know, we're not standing there getting ready for you to fail and then holding up scorecards, you know, some kind of a figure skating judge or something. We're actually going to, we're going to help you through it, and then we're going to see what happened, and then we're going to help you afterwards as well. So I think just reminding people what they're here to do at school is learn. That's it. Mm-hmm. That's their job. That helps to take some of the fear away.
That is so interesting. So I've done a lot of research on anxiety and depression and the rising rates in children, specifically in youth. And yes. It seems as though the disconnection from one another factors in. I think nobody can really exactly say what the cause is, but mm-hmm. also this pressure that we have to achieve. It sounds as though your school and the inquiry-based model serves to support students who may be feeling immense pressures of anxiety type symptoms or depression type symptoms. And through that interactive process, they're able to at least feel connected and supported by their community of learners and that culture. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, absolutely. If we're going back to what I said earlier about being a cross section of society, I think if we're overrepresented in any place, it is in learners coming to us who have depression and anxiety. That's probably our biggest sort of identifiable group of people with challenges. And they're coming to us because they're hearing this is the place to go. This is the way to do things if you're struggling with those things. And so really what's interesting is sometimes the anxiety itself or the depression itself or learning about that becomes the inquiry. So someone can actually do some pretty deep, you know, self-exploration on something that's really important to them. It doesn't have to be sitting in the background and kind of getting in the way while they try to do, you know, chemistry and math and physics and English. They might be doing English, but we might say, hey, here's a really interesting book that has a character in it that may have a kind of depression that's a little bit similar to some of the things you've described to me when we've talked about it. And then they read that book, and we can have a discussion about that, talk about how it's the same, how it's different. We just did a lesson today where we were teaching a small group of people how cognitive behavioral therapy works, and how you set out a plan for yourself by setting some measures first to sort of make sure your thinking is not faulty. And so that's very practical for people, but it's also, you know, really high level learning, and also makes them feel pretty good. So it does definitely help with people's, you know, anxiety. I think the other thing that is interesting is we almost induce anxiety a little bit. Again, that late October period when the new learners compare what they're doing with, say, their cousin in another school that's right. more traditional, and they go, they're on chapter 11 in the social studies textbook, and we don't even have a social studies textbook.
Right.
And so we are really transparent about what the curriculum, the actual British Columbia curriculum where we live, is, so that they can see what it actually says, and they can assure themselves they're doing fine. All that other stuff is what the teachers are making up to try to achieve those outcomes. They're just creating their own activities to achieve those outcomes. So that relieves some pressure as well. And most kids have said they've never seen the actual curriculum before. It's always through the filter of the teacher.
Interesting. So what would you say about that in terms of the importance of, and of course you don't want to necessarily focus on the outcome, but to talk about the importance of discussing and really talking about the curriculum as a document and something that students as learners should really be aware of?
Yeah, I think what they're surprised by is how thin it really is, and how sort of malleable and minimal it is. They're usually really shocked, and they say, you know, I don't see anything here about Lord of the Flies. How come I had to read Lord of the Flies? And it's like, well, you can read it if you want to, but there's flexibility. It's at a higher level. It's sort of you know, 20,000 feet in the air kind of a curriculum. So it really does give them not only the idea of what it is they really are trying to achieve and why, but also it shows them a path for interdisciplinary learning. So they'll often say, this outcome here in this course is the same as this one in this course and this one in this course. I'm like, I know. They said, so if I was in a normal school, I would be doing this over and over again 3 times. Like, that's correct. So they're saying, so is it okay for me to combine those into one interdisciplinary project? I was like, absolutely. So they start to see some efficiency, but it also shows them that, you know, the world hangs together a little bit better. It's not, the world is not divided up into subject areas. The world is a place, and all of these ideas are important, and they work together, not separately.
Absolutely. So in that vein, then, what advice would you give to a teacher who is interested in exploring this model but isn't quite sure how to start? Do you think that it's possible to dip your toe in, or are you an all or nothing kind of person when it comes to inquiry-based learning?
That's a great question. I was just arguing with somebody about this the other day. I have to admit, I go back and forth on this, because one part of me thinks that if people don't dip their toe into it to some degree, they may not ever find themselves in an environment where they can do it fully, because it really does require a change in setting in a pretty big way. You have to have a whole school pretty much on board, because you have to change so much, so many of the structures that underlie the way we do things. So I think I would have to say, you know, people should try it, you know, dip their toe in. But I think in order to do it authentically and say, I've really done inquiry-based learning, you have to let go of a few things. And, you know, one of them is, I've heard people say, you know, yes, we're doing inquiry-based learning. We're inquiring about birds. They can inquire about owls or robins or peacocks. And so it gets very, very limited. It gets narrowed down. I think if teachers want to try inquiry, they have to blow it right up, make it interdisciplinary as much as possible. And if they can connect with other teachers, if they're in a high school, let's say, where they're specialists and they can't really be interdisciplinary as much as they'd like to be, try to mix it up with another teacher. See if you can do something where they can spread it across more than one subject area. And I think that's really important. And then I think the other part is, don't worry so much about what the outcome is. Don't try to create some kind of a parallel outcome for each learner. Try to make the goals competency-based goals instead of outcome goals. I think it'll be a lot easier for you to be able to keep your stomach down while you're on this bumpy ride, because you feel really insecure as a teacher. We're taught to watch for these outcomes and to treat everybody the same. And all of a sudden you're doing the exact opposite.
Yes. And I think that's ultimately what freaks some of the teachers that I've talked to, that freaks them right out. There's sort of this wall that goes up, and this perception that, well, it works for other people, but it certainly will not work for me. And I'm trying to keep my hat on as it is. So no, thank you. You know, so I'm really eager to talk to teachers about it, and also mindful that it can be difficult because these walls do come up. So that's an interesting thing. I do want to switch gears a little bit again. I know that you are a fan of Brené Brown. I'm a huge fan of hers. And I would say that the really embracing vulnerability has changed the way that I parent, has changed the way that I teach, the way that I perceive people. And she says that that vulnerability is the truest measure of courage. How would you say that vulnerability has factored into your experiences as an educational leader and as the creator of this school?
Well, that's such a good question. I've never really thought about that before, but as you're asking the question, I'm thinking about it. Thank you for that. I think again, it's a little bit about some personal transparency. So our staff is pretty good about, letting the kids at the school know what kinds of challenges we are facing as we create this model and as we shift from more traditional teaching to this inquiry-based teaching, because it really is it's a learning process for us as well. So we kind of share that vulnerability. We also, you know, sometimes purposely sort of out our vulnerabilities in certain cases where we know that's going to be really helpful to somebody. So, you know, you'll talk about things you tried to do that didn't work, or something that you really wish you could do better, but you can't. just every once in a while, you just sort of throw it out there. And it starts to create a little bit of a gentle playfulness where people are learning a better edge where you can kind of, you know, make a little bit of fun of somebody in a really friendly way and also really let them know that you're not judging them on the basis of that vulnerability. You're sort of, you're sharing in that, you know, that vulnerability with them in a sort of more of a spirit of community. So we do that a lot. And so there's a lot of very, very healthy making fun of each other. I had to fix a light bulb the other day and I was glad to climb into the ceiling to figure out where it was, where the stupid thing was plugged in. We have one of those artificial drop ceilings with the tiles.
Oh, yes.
So I'm standing on a ladder and half of my body's in the ceiling, half of my body's in the ladder. And one of the girls at school took a picture of me and then created a meme out of it that says, you don't know Jeff. And all of a sudden I see this thing all over the internet. It was like, thanks a lot. And so we had this really, really, really funny conversation about that. And so it's that kind of like, she knew that I would not mind that at all. Of course, I immediately told her that she was expelled.
Yeah.
And, you know, and she knew I didn't mean that either. And it was just a lot of fun. So you sort of poke fun at each other, which allows us to kind of deal with the difficult things when they come up as well. Because, you know, we know we're all kind of rowing in the same direction.
Absolutely. And I think really what people are looking for in one another when we're trying to build connections is that vulnerability piece. And I think that is something that it's taken me a very long time to understand myself. And that the tendency, especially when we're like I'm a certainty seeker by nature, and I would say probably a lot of teachers are, is this desire to perceive or to present as though we've got it all figured out. And it sort of creates this armor. And so that's part of my intrigue, I guess, into this whole idea of vulnerability, is the fact that it's actually the key to creating these really powerful relationships. There's also another piece around, you know, even sharing embarrassing stories or embarrassing situations that can really open the door, and research has shown this, can open the door to creativity and innovation. Have you seen that to be true?
I have, and I think it is, again, about being, you know, just being, letting yourself be vulnerable enough to share that embarrassment or that embarrassing moment with people. 'Cause really, I mean, as a teacher, most teachers sort of lose a fair bit of their ego after a while, 'cause you kind of have to. And in our school, I think you lose it even more, because there will be times where you do not know exactly what someone needs. You just don't. They're much more of an expert on something than you are. And it happens all the time.
Yeah.
And that's not very comfortable for most of us, because we've all been taught we're supposed to be the smartest person in the room or the most knowledgeable about a particular subject. And it's just not the case. It probably never was, but it really isn't now. So sharing that with the learner, saying, you know, I should probably know that, but I don't. Wow, this is great. You're 14 and I'm 49 and you're asking me a question, I can't answer it. And you're going to find the answer in 5 minutes and it might take me a year. So you just sort of, I just say it like that sometimes, and they think that's pretty funny.
Yes.
But then what we see then is the generosity that comes out of that is, like, just yesterday, one of our learners who really understands the stock market quite well, historically and also currently, and, understands its relationship to the economy versus, like, things like monetary theory. He's like got it really down to a fine point. He knows more than any of us, and so he's offered to teach some sessions in it. So he's going to be teaching next week, and we're just going to be sort of working together, so I can help him with the how do you teach things to people part, and he's going to do the actual content of the lesson and sort of deliver it. And for him, that learning is, he is terrified to talk to a group of people. Mm. So he's ready to do it. He's going to do it. And he's got the knowledge. So, me just explaining to him, like, I'm embarrassed that you know so much more than me, is resulting in a great learning experience for him, where he's going to take a big risk.
Wow. I just can't help but put myself in your shoes and think back to that moment on the roof. And then thinking now, and you must just feel so proud, and you must be feel, I mean, maybe you can tell me how you feel when you hear that kind and you see and you witness that type of learning, authentic learning happening that you know will transfer to real life.
I think the first thing I feel is relieved, because I have to say, like, I'm being really honest, at first it was like, I don't think this is going to work. Like, this is too crazy, and I'm in too deep, and there were all sorts of things that I hadn't anticipated, even little things like financial things and all. I thought, well, we're not going to make it, but each year it's got better and better, and it's really is a sense of relief. And I don't know if I'm proud is the right word. I just feel really happy. Like I enjoy going to work. I really love working with the kids at our school. I see them all the time after they graduate. We talk to each other like on social media. And if I just rode the bus home with somebody the other day who graduated a couple of years ago, we had a great chat all the way out. So it's just, you just feel like you're creating this community that just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger and more interconnected. So I feel pretty happy about that.
I can imagine that must be very, very rewarding. I'm going to ask you a question on self-care and on mindfulness. Do you create sort of a deliberate space or time for mindfulness practice, or, you know, for kids to tap out when they need to? It sounds as though you do, but I guess I'm wondering if you do anything that's outside of maybe anything that we've talked about.
Yeah, we have done different things at different times. We actually created a mindful meditation time, and it wasn't really taken up very well. And I think what we found is that the time when people want to do that isn't necessarily the same as, you know, the time we had planned for it.
Certainly.
So what we have now is in the school, we have really differentiated spaces. We have one room that's creatively called the quiet space because it's quiet. And we have another one that's called the collaborative space. And it's very noisy, kind of by design. It sort of sounds like a cafe all the time.
Right.
And then other rooms that have, less stimulation and more stimulation. We have one room that has absolutely no windows in it, and it's called the cave. And we use, LED lighting in shades so that we don't have any fluorescent lights on overhead anywhere, just because it's just much, much nicer. So
yes.
what we're trying to help the kids see is that you really do need to pay attention to environment, and you also need to pay attention to yourself and make sure you're thinking about what kind of space you need to be in based on how you're feeling at any given time. We talk a lot about mindful practice, and we talk a lot about being present. It's really interesting when working with learners who are on the autism spectrum, they seem to benefit so much from talking about mindful practice, because quite often they may find themselves in a place where they're quite concerned about something that's coming up in the future or something that's happened in the past, or they're thinking about something very much inside their own head. And suddenly that mindful practice helps them be present. And we're seeing that, pay huge dividends in terms of communicating with people, recognizing subtle social gestures and things like that. So mindfulness is really kind of part and parcel of everything we're doing. And we some learners do have a time when they meditate, but most of them just pay attention to what they need to do all the way through the day. We're creating a little mental health space, a little room. We're actually expanding our space a little bit next year, which is a good thing because we're running out of space. But one of our learners wrote a grant to a mental health agency and received a bit of funding and is creating a sort of a mental health, I don't even know what you'd call it, like a little drop-in space that we have a weighted blanket and some fidget toys and a couple things like that. So if someone needs to just sort of go somewhere and just do that,
yes.
they have a place to go where they know where it is. They don't have to find it or think about it or ask anybody for anything. You can just go and do that.
And that's so wonderful. And I just think about the agency for a student to be the one to come up with that solution. How incredibly powerful. So I really want to be mindful and respectful of your time. So I'm just wondering, before we launch into the rapid fire questions, are there any other things that are close to your heart, or any pieces that maybe we didn't touch on that you wish to talk about?
I don't think the only thing the only thing that I ever find myself saying a lot, and I might as well say it, is just, unfortunately, a lot of the words we use about education get kind of taken over and can develop new connotations that aren't really intended. So, personalized learning has been kind of wrecked a little bit by how it's been used, and so has inquiry-based learning. And I would just really encourage people to to dig deep to make sure that when they say they've tried inquiry-based learning or they know what inquiry-based learning is, that they really take some time to dig deep to see all the different things that can mean. I've just met a lot of people who said, oh yeah, I do inquiry-based learning, and they tell me what it is. And it's like, yeah, not really. That's kind of like a research project,
sure.
which is part of the inquiry process, but it can go a lot deeper. So I think that's all I would say is just, you know, don't sort of turn your nose up at it until you're sure what it is that you're considering.
Absolutely. And I know that you work a lot with Trevor McKenzie, who is the author yeah. of Dive Into Inquiry, and also yeah. The inquiry base or the inquiry mindset with Rebecca Bathurst-Hunt, who I'm actually mm-hmm. going to have an interview with further along in the month. But great. Yeah, so though I would say in terms of resources, I'd highly recommend those two books. Also, your website actually has some wonderful printable PDF documents for the classroom and sort of a breakdown yeah. of the inquiry process. Is there anywhere else that you would recommend teachers visit to gain more information or to dig a little deeper?
Well, we're going to be putting a lot more information on our website of things that we use in the school. We honestly sort of had a decision to make about, you know, do we spend our time doing it or do we spend our time creating documents for people to see?
Sure.
And we're now trying to get a little bit more of it out there onto our website. So people go to our website a lot and they take a lot of things. We've also had over 1,200 visitors now to the school
wow.
From all over the world. And so we have a lot of people who come to not only sort of see the tools we use, but the context in which we're using them. I was just speaking with Trevor McKenzie the other night, and he was kind of giving me a hard time about, like, how come you haven't written a book yet?
Seriously.
And we sort of have a different approach to some degree. He's a proponent of slightly more guided inquiry than I am. Mm. But they're not mutually exclusive. They're just a little bit, there's a little bit of space where, you know, they don't quite overlap in 100%. Mm. So he's sort of saying, you should get that down on paper sometime. I said, yeah, well, you know, one day I will try and do that. I was, yeah, feeling a little bit, yeah.
With all your free time.
Yeah, with all my free time. I think he actually said that. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
fair. That's fair.
So those resources are really good. And I also I think anything by Yang Zhao, even though he's not talking about inquiry learning, he's talking about what education needs to be doing if we're actually helping people participate in our world right now. Mm. He doesn't use the word inquiry learning very often, but he does certainly imply it heavily. In talking about, you know, de-standardizing outcomes and letting people go deep into areas of interest and passion and, you know, building competency instead of content and things like that.
And quote unquote, the soft skills. Yes, I've seen some of his yeah. videos. They're really powerful. Absolutely.
Yeah, they really are.
Yes. Well, here are some rapid fire questions for you.
Okay.
Could you define what kindness means to you?
I think kindness to me means, I don't know, doing something nice for somebody without wanting anything in return.
Mm-hmm. What book or books have you gifted most often to people?
There's two books that I've gifted most often. One is Lullaby for Little Criminals by Heather O'Neill. And the other one is Flow by Csikszentmihalyi.
Oh, yes. Yes. That's, you know, what's interesting, I'm going to interject, is that that his idea of flow just speaks so much to this sounds so woo-woo, but to my soul. And I think mm-hmm. that's what I was thinking the whole time with our conversation is that it seems to be the target for you is to have these students in flow so that they're learning most authentically. So I'm not surprised.
Yes.
What one skill or superpower does a teacher need to lead with in order to be effective?
Well, it's interesting. You've already said it, vulnerability.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that it's different for a school leader, like a principal?
I don't think it is. I think it's the same. And I think it's important for the school leader to show that same vulnerability if you expect the teachers to do it.
Absolutely. Here's the last one. What message or quote would you print on one of those quote cups that are sold in the big bookstores that would be read by millions? So essentially, what's your key message to people?
I'm going to cheat. I have two. One of them is a quote from a poem. I cannot remember the author, so this is terrible, but it's we use it sometimes, and it's "The path is made by walking."
Mm.
And I really like that quote. And I guess the other one would be learning is better than perfect.
Mm, absolutely. Absolutely.
And I think I made up the second one, but the first one I definitely stole. So.
Perfect. It doesn't matter. That's learning, right? You just, and teaching. Yeah. You take and you borrow and you change it and you adapt. This has been such a delight. I really, really appreciate the time and I appreciate your openness and vulnerability. I think you're incredible and I love what you're doing. So thank you so much for sharing that with me and sharing it with our audience. And I know that it's going to be a really useful conversation for people to hear.
Well, that's great. And I really have to thank you for reaching out to do this. I was surprised and was just really happy to be able to do this. I love the questions you asked. This is really different from really anything anyone's ever asked me before. So thank you.
This has been another episode of Kindsight 101, the podcast. For links to resources mentioned in this episode, visit smallactbigimpact.com and click on our podcast and choose this episode number. Now, I'd love to give my audience a heads up about my new book, which will provide ideas, actionable strategies, and inquiry-based approaches to creating kinder classroom through serving the community. Subscribe to my blog for more information. Now, I would love to hear from you. What's the biggest insight that you gain from this conversation? Head over to our website, smallactbigimpact.com, leave a comment on our podcast page, or tag and connect with us on social media with the hashtag #SmallActBigImpact to share your inspiring story of kindness. Can't wait to hear from you.